Hello, it's Adam from the Tudor Chest here. In addition to the Tudor Chest, I'm also the director of a historic tour company, Simply Tudor Tours, which I run alongside Sarah Morris, known to many of you as the Tudor Travel Guide. This summer, over a three-month window, we have an online learning experience that we have created consisting of seven seminars with leading historians including Natalie Gruniger, Sandra Fasoli, Nikki Clark, and today's podcast guest, Sylvia Barbara Soberton, all about some of the lesser-known aspects of Anne Boleyn's life, from her earliest days to her household, connections to witchcraft, and that final letter that she may or may not have written from the Tower. The Rise and Fall of Anne Boleyn online experience provides an amazing opportunity to get closer to one of history's most fascinating but often elusive figures. To secure your place on the programme, just head to simplytudortours.com. One of the most powerful and influential women at the court of King Henry VIII is someone you've probably never heard of, or perhaps only heard of fleetingly, Gertrude Courtenay, Marchioness of Exeter. As the wife of King Henry VIII's cousin, Henry Courtenay, Gertrude was a central figure at King Henry's court and would find herself on the wrong side of the law a couple of times, but most prominently when she became embroiled in a period known as the Exeter Conspiracy, which would eventually lead to her husband's execution and her son's imprisonment. To discuss this fascinating figure with me today, I'm pleased to welcome historian and author Sylvia Barbara Soberton onto the podcast. Sylvia Barbara's book, The Forgotten Tudor Woman, Gertrude Courtenay, Wife and Mother of the Last Plantagenets, is the basis for our discussion. We explore Gertrude's early life, her marriage, her rise and then fall at the royal court, her final years, and her legacy. Who was Gertrude Courtenay, and why is history all but overlooked her story? Welcome back to the Tudor Chest Podcast, episode 34, Gertrude Courtenay, Marchioness of Exeter, with Sylvia Barbara Soberton. Welcome to the Tudor Chest Podcast, Sylvia Barbara Soberton. How are you?
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I'm great, and how are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. So we're here today to talk about a fascinating lady, Gertrude Courtenay, Marchioness of Exeter, who you've written a book on. But before we get into the discussion about Gertrude, I just wanted to ask a few questions just for people to get to know you a bit better. So could you just provide us with a bit of sort of your background, where you grew up, and what you do full time?
So I'm a writer, historian, and researcher specializing in the history of the Tudors. I currently live in Slovenia with husband and two children. I'm a full-time writer. I do history of the Tudors every day. So I'm very lucky in that respect.
And what sparked your passion for particularly Tudor history? Was there a particular moment growing up or something you watched that made you really become very interested in Tudor history?
I was a curious and bookish child, and I loved watching period dramas on TV, and I always enjoyed fact-checking them afterwards. So I think it's fair to say that period dramas were my gateway to history.
Have you got a favourite one? Have you got a favourite that you go back to, you can watch over and over again?
Just in general terms, I like all of the period dramas, but like my favorite one that I think I could watch almost every day is The Anonymous. It's a fairly recent. It's about the Earl of Oxford and how he was a Shakespeare. I mean, I don't believe that. I think it's not a good, in terms of accuracy, it's not accurate, but it's such a lavish period drama. It's beautifully done. The acting is superb, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it.
Yeah, the costumes in that film are
Yes.
incredible.
Amazing.
And I loved the fact that you had a mother and daughter, Jolie Richardson and Vanessa Redgrave playing
Yes.
younger and older Elizabeth. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, I love them. Yeah. Yes. Oh my gosh, that's the best period drama ever.
That's an unusual one, though. That's not one I would hear often.
Yeah, because it's not accurate. I think people don't really like to bring it up because it's not accurate, and many people don't want to see, you know, Shakespeare's identity being ascribed to someone else. And I think that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare. I believe he was who he said he was, but it's just such a good story, you know.
Yeah.
And the Earl of Oxford, it's such a believable character. I loved it.
So is there a Tudor misconception that you would love to change?
Yeah, I think it would be the one that yellow was the color of mourning in Spain. It wasn't. I don't know where it came from, but it wasn't. And the colors of mourning in Spain were black, gray, and sometimes also white. And yellow was never a color of mourning. And I think that's the biggest misconception when I read. It still circulates today in recent books. So I would love this one to just go away.
So based on that, then, you're very much of the opinion that when Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn wore yellow, they were wearing it as a sign of happiness, not of mourning.
Yes. Yes, I think so. I mean, we don't know if Anne wore it because we only have chronicler Edward Hall, who says that she wore yellow, and he says for mourning. And I think that's where the misconception was born, that she wore yellow for mourning. But I think when Hall wrote that she wore it for mourning, he meant that she was rejoicing because Catherine died. And there is also this excerpt from the Spanish Chronicle, this anonymous account that was written later in the 16th century. And it says that Henry VIII wore yellow, and it was calculated as an insult because yellow was the color of rejoicing in England. So, yeah, I think Henry was celebrating, definitely.
Yeah, that's definitely how I've always seen it as well. It's definitely not.
Yeah.
There's no precedence for it. There's no precedence for yellow being a color of mourning ever.
Yeah, it's I think it's only in Asia in the early Middle Ages. But it's like in Europe, I've never seen it in that context.
Yeah.
So not a color of mourning, definitely not.
So we're here today, as I mentioned at the start of the episode, to talk about Gertrude Courtenay. And she's a character that I think is, as you may know, I've written a book about the Pole family. And Gertrude Courtenay and Margaret Pole are kind of like almost two sides of the same coin, I think, in many respects. So a lot of what you were looking at was the sort of the same sources that I was looking at when I was writing my book. So I'm really happy to talk to you today because she is such a fascinating woman, but not a particularly well-known one. And I think that's part of again, what makes your book so fascinating. So can you introduce us to Gertrude Courtenay? Who was she and what was her tie to the court of Henry VIII?
So she was the daughter of William Blount, the fourth Baron of Mountjoy, and Elizabeth Say. She was serving as a maid of honor and then as lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon. She married Henry Courtenay, Earl of Devonshire, and later Marquess of Exeter. So she was born into aristocracy and later married into royalty. She lived at the pinnacle of the Tudor society, and I think that's what makes her life so interesting.
You mentioned that she was born Gertrude Blount. Is there any connection whatsoever to Bessie Blount, or is it just a coincidence?
Yes, but that's a very... they were not close. But yes, they were the family... the family connection is definitely there, but they were like distant cousins. And I don't think that she felt particularly close to Bessie. I haven't found any evidence that they had contacts or in exchange letters or anything like that.
So what were her early years like? Who were, you mentioned that she was born into the nobility, but she wasn't born, you know, she wasn't the daughter of a duke. She was born, I suppose, into the middling nobility. What were her early years like and who were her parents?
So unfortunately, we don't really know that much about her early years because they were not recorded. We don't even know the exact date of her birth. Because, you know, it wasn't fashionable at that time to record births of your children. But some families kept birth order of their children in Books of Hours or in other books, but we don't have her year of birth. We know that her father was William Blount, 4th Baron Mountjoy, and that he served as the chamberlain to Catherine of Aragon from 1512 to 1533. Her mother was Elizabeth Say, daughter of Sir John Say and Elizabeth Cheney. And through the Say family, Gertrude was related to both Anne Boleyn and Jane Seymour. And we don't really have that a clear view of Gertrude's education, but we have some clues. So for example, her father was a noted scholar and humanist, and so he certainly took care of his daughter's education. We know that she was taught to read and write because there are her letters. Some of them survive. Some of them we know are referenced by other people. And she certainly also knew French because later in her life, she was able to conduct secret communications with the imperial ambassador Eustace Chapuis, whose native language was French. Later in her life, she also performed in courtly entertainments. So she must have been a skilled dancer and musician. Playing instruments and singing were very highly valued skills in a woman, especially in a lady-in-waiting. And I think that Catherine of Aragon oversaw the education of her young charges. So Gertrude probably benefited from the royal patronage.
So in 1519, she makes what would have been a very, very good marriage. She marries into the extended royal family. So who was her husband, and what was the connection to the royal family? He was a member of the old York family. Who were they?
So she married Henry Courtney, the Earl of Devonshire. He was Henry VIII's first cousin because their mothers were sisters. Henry and the king were brought up together. Henry's mother was Catherine of York, and she was the last Plantagenet princess at the Tudor court. She was the last surviving daughter of Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville, and she died in 1527. Henry received a title of Marquess of Exeter in 1525, and that's how he's referred to by his contemporaries, as the Marquis of Exeter or My Lord of Exeter. That's how history remembers him.
Yeah, his mother was actually the longest lived of Edward IV's children as well, wasn't she? I think she outlived all of her siblings by more than a decade or something.
Yes, and she was the last Plantagenet princess. Mm-hmm. I like to refer to her as the last Plantagenet princess, although I also like to refer to Margaret Pole as the last Plantagenet princess at the Tudor court, although Margaret was not a princess per se. She was she was an aristocrat and she was a niece of the king, but the real princess, if we think about it, it was Catherine of York.
Yeah.
And she lived until 1527, so quite a long time. She saw quite a lot of history of the Tudors unfolding, but unfortunately she died right before Henry VIII started his divorce case. So she would have been in for a ride, but unfortunately she died. But yeah, her son and daughter-in-law saw quite a lot of that history.
Yeah, she was definitely, and I agree with you, with Margaret Pole, she was mm-hmm. seen as a Princess of York, but didn't have the title. She was never Princess Margaret in the way that Princess Catherine was Princess Catherine. So she was definitely the... Where Margaret Pole was the sort of the last grand dame of the York dynasty, she wasn't a princess in the way that Catherine was. So following her marriage and the fact that she was a member of Catherine of Aragon's faction, she became very close to Catherine. So what were Gertrude's feelings towards Anne Boleyn when the King's Great Matter eventually broke out?
So Gertrude served as Catherine of Aragon's maid of honor from a very young age, and she was fiercely loyal to her. I think that loyalty to the queen was Gertrude's driving force. It is also likely that she saw Catherine as a mother figure and that they also bonded over their losses because they both suffered stillbirths. So when Anne Boleyn became Henry VIII's love interest in 1527, Gertrude disliked her from the beginning, and she actually became one of her staunchest enemies at court. Anne's rise was perceived as this assault on moral values. She was perceived by many as the king's mistress, although she didn't technically sleep with him. But still, people saw her as the mistress, as the whore, and she was called many names and slanders. Gertrude was a Catholic like the queen, whereas Anne was evangelical, and she wanted to see the people of England reading the Bible in vernacular, whereas Gertrude and her husband enjoyed Latin as the language of the church. So there was this difference between them. Gertrude and her husband were vociferous critics of the king's divorce and, of course, blamed Anne for seducing him away from Catherine. And they spread rumors that she used unlawful love to enchant the king, and they called her a harlot and a heretic. So definitely not friends. And Anne, of course, she knew very well that Gertrude was her enemy, that she was slandering her. And so in 1530, Anne used her influence on the king and dismissed Gertrude from Catherine's service, because she knew that this would be a huge blow to both Catherine and Gertrude. In 1531, Gertrude's husband was ejected from the privy chamber, ostensibly because there were rumors that he was plotting against the king, but he was really ejected because he was a staunch supporter of Catherine of Aragon, and Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn absolutely hated that. During the 1520s, late 1520s and early 1530s, Gertrude was definitely not Anne Boleyn's friend, and she kept very close to the queen until the moment that she was dismissed and couldn't serve the queen anymore.
I think that's one of the big things about Anne Boleyn's story that's not as necessarily well perceived, is that really it was a lot of the very senior women at the court who were the key opponents to Anne Boleyn. And, you know, the most prominent figure among that number was Princess Mary, the king's younger sister, but very closely hot on her heels was Gertrude, Margaret Pole, Anne's own aunt, the Duchess of Norfolk. You know, it was these very powerful senior women of the Tudor court that were actually much more vocal about their hatred of Anne Boleyn than a lot of the men were. And I think that's an aspect of Anne's story that's not particularly well known.
Yes, exactly. And when I was writing the book about ladies-in-waiting who served Anne Boleyn, and then about Gertrude, I was really kind of shocked that there was this woman who was opposing Anne every step of the way, and she was never her friend. She always slandered her so openly, and yet, you know, people have never heard about her. That was a very fascinating aspect of writing about Gertrude, to uncover her story and see how her story is intertwined with Anne's and with Catherine's. Because when you shift the perspective, and when you tell the story through the eyes of people who are not that famous, so lesser known characters, it becomes a little bit different story, and you understand the motivations and loyalties of these people. And it's really fascinating when you think about it.
Despite her clear hatred for Anne Boleyn, Gertrude Courtenay had a role to play at Anne Boleyn's coronation, I believe. So can you talk to us about this? And do you think it was do you think she was deliberately chosen as a way of being spiteful?
So Gertrude was Catherine of Aragon's most staunchest supporter and loyalist. No question about that. And she played a very prominent and visible role during Anne's coronation. She opened the cavalcade of women who rode on horseback. She was even the first one her horse was the first one. So that's very interesting. And I think that was a deliberate choice on Henry VIII's part, because he was sending a message to Catherine's friends that everyone and anyone can be broken, and that submission was what was that the king, you know, he wanted submission from his subjects, and he would not tolerate anyone being loyal to his former wife, because loyalty was owed to him, not to Catherine. And also later in September, when Princess Elizabeth was born, Gertrude was also made one of her godmothers. So again, a very visible ceremonial role. And we actually have her reaction to this, because she said to her friends, and she was, you know, saying this at court, that she really wanted to have nothing to do with this, but she did it so as not to displease the king, because that was a kind of a tricky situation, I guess, to found yourself in, because people at the Tudor court, the courtiers, they owned their loyalty to the king. The king was the source of royal patronage, favor, and you wanted to please him, not the queen, obviously. But, you know, Gertrude loved the queen, and she felt that she should be loyal to her. And Henry absolutely hated that. So, yeah, he wanted to just break her will, show the people, look, I can break anyone. You should support me, not Catherine. So that was a clear signal to all.
So the first time that Gertrude comes under, I suppose, close scrutiny from Henry VIII, and it's also around this time that obviously Thomas Cromwell is really coming through the ranks, was her close association with Elizabeth Barton, who is known as the Holy Maid of Kent, or the Maid of Kent. So for those who may not know much about this woman, who was she, and how, what was she saying, what was she doing, and how did Gertrude become involved?
So, Elizabeth Barton was known as the Holy Maid of Kent. She was a nun, a prophetess, and a visionary. She was backed by prominent supporters and had followers at court. Gertrude was one of them, of course. And Barton incurred the king's anger when she started spreading prophecies about him. So she said, for example, that if he married Anne Boleyn, he would not live one month, or that she saw a place in hell reserved for him. She also experienced trances during which she received divine revelations, or so she said. And Barton attracted a considerable following and spread her prophecies to a wider audience. So most people, at least in London, they knew who she was and what was she saying about the king. And by autumn of 1533, Henry VIII decided to act and had her arrested because she talked too much about politics, and she casted slanders on Anne Boleyn and the king. And she also talked about the succession and how it should go to Princess Mary. So Henry VIII obviously couldn't have this woman casting political prophecies about him, slandering him, and saying people that she saw him in hell. You know, that was absolutely, you know, Henry VIII hated anyone who opposed him. And so over the course of the investigation, Barton said that in June of 1533, Gertrude invited her to her manor at West Horsley Place in Surrey. And she was Gertrude was allegedly interested in Barton's prophecies concerning the king's reign. And Barton obviously tried to shield Gertrude from the king's anger, and she didn't say anything about the prophecies. She didn't say anything about that. She said that Gertrude wanted Barton to pray so that she could have more children, because she had only one son and experienced several stillbirths. So that was perfectly acceptable for, let's say, a noblewoman like Gertrude to request a holy woman like the nun of Kent to pray for her, you know, so that she can have children. And it's interesting that the details, more details about Gertrude's involvement with a nun of Kent, came out later in 1538 and 1539, when Gertrude's husband was arrested. But at the time when the nun was interrogated, she tried to shield Gertrude from the king's wrath. And I think it's because of that that Gertrude didn't get into much trouble because of that association.
So when Elizabeth Barton was arrested, she was eventually hung. She was also the only woman in history, I believe, who suffered the dishonor of having her head put on a spike at the entrance to London. When that happened, and she was executed, how did it impact Gertrude's position at court? I mean, based on what you've just said, it sounds like it didn't actually impact her that much.
Yes, it's true. It's really kind of surprising. But she didn't suffer consequences for associating with a nun. The king had only warned her not to give ear to such tales ever again. And Gertrude wrote two letters, one to the king, thanking him for his pardon, and one to Thomas Cromwell, thanking him for interceding on her behalf. And in both letters, she basically said that she was just only, you know, only a silly woman. Therefore, she was easily led to believe in the nun's false prophecies. So she distanced herself from the nun and played her woman card, you know, I'm just a woman. I'm easily led by these false prophecies. I will never do that again. And Henry VIII absolutely loved to hear this because he, I think he was a misogynist. He probably hated women. I mean, I think so. And he hated it when women were smarter than him. And here Gertrude was like, I'm not smarter than you. Please forgive me. I was led by the devil. I was, you know, seduced by these false prophecies. And it did her well, you know, it did her good because she was not, she didn't suffer any consequences. She was still a member of the court. She was still a member of the royal household. She was still wealthy and absolutely no consequences for her at this time.
You write that Gertrude and her faction, that they played a key role in helping to establish Jane Seymour on the throne, and as part of that, obviously displace Anne Boleyn. So how were the Courtney family involved in this process of getting Jane Seymour onto the throne?
So when we think about Anne's downfall, we must think about the conservative faction's role. So Gertrude and her husband, then we have Nicholas Carew, Francis Bryan, the Seymours, and Cromwell, who stood in the middle trying to see in which direction the events would go and to jump onto the winning side at the right time. I think that none of them believed that Anne would be executed because they plotted to topple her from the position of power. They often use the words like dismiss and divorce, thinking it would probably end up with Anne's banishment, like it happened with Catherine of Aragon. But unfortunately, as we know, Henry VIII had other plans. So I think they were all very much surprised when Anne Boleyn was executed. So they schemed with the imperial ambassador, Eustace Chapuis, and instructed Jane Seymour how to act. So, for example, they advised her to save her virginity for the marriage bed, much like Anne Boleyn did, tell the king that his marriage to Anne was unpopular. And Gertrude was Chapuis's informant. This is how we know, for example, that Henry VIII sent Jane Seymour a purse filled with money and that she rejected that gift. We know that Gertrude also told Chapuis that Henry VIII courted Jane Seymour in the presence of her family members, so her brother and sister-in-law. So there's a lot of details that come directly from Gertrude. And I also think that because she was related to Jane and because they were both Catholics and that they both favored Princess Mary, Lady Mary, of course, because she was disinherited and only a lady. And I think they bonded over that. And to Gertrude, it was better to see Jane Seymour as queen than to see Anne Boleyn. But ultimately, I think she didn't expect, or none of them, other members of the court, expected that Anne Boleyn would be executed. That was, I think, a huge shock for everybody.
So that quite famous interaction where Jane Seymour, she receives the gift of money and she says, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, I hope the king sends me a gift when I make a good marriage kind of thing. But that interaction made its way to Eustace Chapuis by Gertrude.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So she was quite a schemer in many respects.
She was. Yes, she was. The impression that I have of her is that she was a plotter and a schemer and that she quite enjoyed it. But I think she was doing it because...
Quite brave.
Yeah, brave also because, you know, courageous. Yeah, because if the king caught her, then, I mean, I guess off with her head. But as a woman, you know, she was allowed to do that because if she was a man and Henry VIII caught her doing that, I think he would not hesitate. He would send that person to the block, but she was a woman. So women could do more in that respect, speak more, be slander, of course. But she was also shielded by her status as an aristocratic woman. And yeah, I guess we get to that later on in the conversation too, but it's all very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think the other thing that's, well, and then to your point, yes, we will get to this later on, but she's also shielded by the fact that she isn't born royal. She doesn't have royal blood in
Yes.
her veins in the way that another woman who we will again will come to shortly did. So when Anne Boleyn fell from power, I think it's fair to say that the conservative faction at court, the Courtenays, the Poles, they didn't get the result that they had hoped for with regard to Lady Mary. So what had they been hoping for, and how did this backfire on them?
Yeah, it's very true. So they hoped that Henry VIII would welcome Lady Mary at court unconditionally and reinstate her to the line of succession, and also that he would return to the Catholic Church and that he would make an alliance with Charles V. But that didn't happen. The letters that Lady Mary was sending back and forth to Henry VIII, to Thomas Cromwell, they were quite clear that she believed that it was Anne Boleyn all along who mistreated her. And she was in for a really, really kind of rude awakening when she learned that it was Henry VIII who was the prime mover against her. And so Henry VIII made it very clear that he wanted Mary's submission, so that she acknowledges that she was his bastard daughter, that the marriage between her parents was invalid and unlawful, and only he would welcome her at court only when she did that. And Mary kept her, she stood her ground for quite a while. She said that she can't ac accept that, and there was this also faction that clustered around her. And Henry VIII thought at this time that Gertrude and her husband were putting ideas in Mary's head, that they encouraged her to resist him. And Chapuis was actually the one who suggested to Mary that she should submit to Henry VIII's will, because it looked like the king would pursue her for treason, that he would have her maybe even executed. Be her his daughter or not, he has just executed his wife. So it was dangerous to play with him like that. And so Mary accepted, she submitted to him. She accepted that she was his bastard daughter, that the marriage of her mother and Henry VIII was unlawful. And she didn't even look at what she was signing. She just signed it. And I think it broke her. It broke her in a way that she returned to court. She was welcome, of course, by Jane Seymour, by Henry VIII. But I think from that point on, she really kind of hated Henry VIII even more than before. Because I maybe in a minority of historians believing that that Mary hated her father. She disliked him very strongly for what he did to her, for what he did to her mother. And so yeah. So to return to that original question, I think yeah. The conservatives didn't expect that Henry VIII, would be making problems there, and Lady Mary had to submit first, so she did. And yeah, it was quite a difficult situation, and I think it's not highlighted often enough that in June of 1536, Mary found herself in a situation possibly facing charges of treason, because she was, according to the laws of the kingdom, she was committing treason because she didn't want to accept the king as the head of the church, as the boss, basically. So she was, playing with fire there.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing, isn't it, as well, that the and l like you said a sort of a moment ago, it was a very rude awakening for the sort of the conservative faction at court. And I think it's still felt today with a lot of people's understanding of they see Anne Boleyn as the sort of the wicked stepmother who treated Mary really badly. But actually, I think what becomes very apparent in the wake of Anne Boleyn's death is that all along it was the king that was the driving force behind the decisions taken against his daughter, and that Anne Boleyn was a scapegoat, I think, in a lot of respects, and that actually that is the big shock was that just because Anne was removed did not change. Henry was not going to go back to pre-1533 and reinstate
Exactly.
the monasteries and all the rest of it. It was just I think people were really surprised, and I think it's still felt today. There is still a misunderstanding in the way that Henry VIII is perceived, and that Anne Boleyn is seen as the driving force in a lot of the ways that Mary was treated. But this, I think, is clear that it was driven from her father, not her stepmother.
Yes, there's also this interesting letter that Anne wrote to Lady Mary when she was pregnant, and she said that that Mary should submit to the king and she should accept her demoted position because otherwise the king would proceed against her. And I think Anne was trying to imply that the king was actually pondering, accusing his daughter of treason. And I think Anne was intelligent enough to grasp that this would reflect badly on her, not on the king, because as you say, she would have been made a scapegoat for that, you know. So she was kind of trying to insinuate, suggest to Mary that you should submit. And it would be also good for Anne if Mary did. But Mary never did. She did, but not while Anne was alive. And it's interesting to me that after Anne died, Mary offered her service as maid of honor to Jane Seymour, which is very interesting because Jane Seymour was also like beneath Mary. She was, not that aristocratic. And so for Mary to offer herself as maid of honor is kind of like, it's desperate. She really wanted to be at court. But yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. This part of history is extremely interesting, Mary's youth and how she was mistreated by the king and how that shaped her into the person that she became.
So, not long after Anne Boleyn's execution, obviously Henry VIII marries Jane Seymour, but we then have a few months later a sort of very significant period of civil unrest, which is known as the Pilgrimage of Grace. And off the a sort of almost like an explosion in the middle of all of that is when Reginald Pole sends his what it's referred to as a letter, but it was a book, De Unitate, which was incredibly damaging to the Pole family, and that sort of had big ramifications for the Courtenay family as well, and it really led to what we now refer to as the Exeter Conspiracy. So what was the Exeter Conspiracy? Why was it called that? And how was Gertrude involved?
So it all started with Paul's defense of the unity of the church, which he sent. So the De Unitate. So he sent that in June of 1536. And that was a very explosive pamphlet or book because it defined Reginald Paul's views on papal authority and the king's succession and praised those who died for the refusal to accept Henry's supremacy over the Church of England. And Paul called the king a robber, a murderer, adulterer, and the king was so angry that he proclaimed that he would like to see Paul eat his own heart. And Henry VIII sent his own men after Paul to assassinate him. But when this plan failed, the king decided to punish Paul's family. So Paul's brother, Baron Montague, said that in order to be revenged on Reginald, the king will kill us all. And that's exactly what happened. So the Poles were Henry VIII's real target, I think. The Exeters were guilty by association because they were close friends and relatives. It is called the Exeter Conspiracy because the Marquess of Exeter was the highest in rank among the sentenced, and the king accused him of plotting to steal the crown and murder him and his children. There's no evidence of this anywhere. Quite the contrary. He pledged himself his support to the Lady Mary, and later, when Mary became queen, she favored Gertrude and her son Edward. So she didn't obviously believe that Exeter was after her and wanted to kill her. So the Courtenay and Pole families talked about current political affairs and about the king's health. And it was treason to predict or even imagine the king's death, according to the new Treasons Act of 1534. So the Poles and Courtenays, they certainly talked a lot about the king's death, restoring the new order, seeing a merry world one day, and stuff like that.
While
And
coming to strikes.
yeah, a lot of that. And Baron Montague said also that the king's leg will kill him because Henry VIII was having troubles with wounds on his leg, like after the 1536 accident on the tilt yard. And these words were harsh, but were they treason? So they were construed as treason under the 1534 Treasons Act, because it was asserted that anyone who maliciously wishes or desires by words of writing, or even if they were imagining this, any bodily harm to the king, that this is treason. So in Tudor England after 1534, words are treasonous, even if you utter them behind the closed doors. Because it's important to highlight that these words were reported to the king by Geoffrey Pole, Reginald Pole's other brother, who was arrested in November of 1538 and possibly tortured. But there is no real evidence of that, but possibly he could have been. So he says all of those things. He provides scraps of gossip, of snippets of conversations between his family. And that's really how it becomes known to the king. But Henry VIII had the Poles and the Exeters under surveillance for quite a while before arresting them. So I think he knew about these conversations in a while. Henry VIII wanted them gone. He wanted them gone to revenge himself on Reginald Pole. And that's exactly what happened.
And I'm in complete agreement with you. In my book, which is about the rise and fall of the Pole family, you know, so as we've said.
I can't wait to read it, yeah.
Yeah, it's coming out in July. So not long. So it's very much the other side of your story. But I totally agree with you, and I conclude very clearly that, yes, they technically were guilty of treason because of what they said. Now, whilst to those of us in 2024, you know, a conversation between cousins and brothers and saying, oh, the king might die, is speculative discussion, we always have to keep in mind the context of the Treasons Act of 1534, and that this was enough. And that, yes, they weren't, there wasn't an outright plot, or at least I don't believe there was, but there was that technicality that made particularly the Pole men much more so, and I'm in complete agreement with you again, that the Marquess of Exeter in particular, I think even less so than Gertrude, there is barely anything to pin against Henry Courtenay. And really, I sort of say that it shouldn't be known as the Exeter conspiracy.
Yes,
it should
exactly.
It should be known as the problem Pole, which was Reginald. You know?
Yes. Yes, he was the real target, really, when Henry VIII couldn't lay his hands on him.
Had Henry got hold of Reginald Pole, I think none of it would have happened.
Yes. I think so. I think that's why he sent assassins after him. I think he just wanted him gone, assassinated, murdered. But, you know, they couldn't do it. And I think if they did, I don't think that the Exeter conspiracy would have been a thing today. They would probably survive Henry VIII's reign. It's pretty, you know, it's sad to think about it that this happened, because these people were Henry VIII's cousins as well. Henry Courtenay, he was brought up with the king. They were not only friends, they were like brothers. He was his closest family, really. So it's really kind of tragic and sad to think that he got rid of him so easily. And I think that the Exeter conspiracy was, to the people who lived at the time, as scandalous and as tragic as Anne Boleyn's execution. Because today we think about Anne, and she was queen, executed for adultery, probably on trumped up charges. But the Poles and the Courtenays, they were aristocratic, almost royal. So their fall took everybody by surprise as well.
Yeah, and I think what's also so shocking about it is when you look at the earlier years of Henry VIII's reign, how much favour he gave to the White Rose Network, as they're known, you know, the Poles, the Courtenays, the Della Poles, the Staffords, all of these White Rose families in the early years of Henry VIII's reign are really close members of his inner circle, you know, and show he showed them a lot of affection because, you know, I think one of the things about Henry VIII that is clear is how much he adored his mother. And I think that, you know, he really wanted to distinguish himself from his father's reign. And his father's reign had been quite, they kept the White Rose Network quite downtrodden. I mean, Margaret Pole's marriage was shockingly poor for who she
Yeah,
was, you know?
definitely.
And that's why, that's also one of the reasons why the Exeter conspiracy is so shocking, because Henry VIII effectively turned on a group of people who, for the longest time, he really supported and loved.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, there's really I think it was one of Henry VIII's chaplains who said that I remember when Your Majesty was, you know, so angry at Paul for this invective that you said that you wanted to see him eat his own heart. And I think that's just such a brilliant line
Yeah.
because it's true, you know, because Henry VIII really wanted to see Reginald eat his own heart. And he did, after all, because his mother was executed, his brother was executed, Henry Courtenay was swept along and executed. And, you know, Henry Courtenay's son was imprisoned in the tower, and Paul's nephew was imprisoned in the tower. He probably also died there. So it's interesting. The princess in the tower, right? Another.
Yeah, that's, I refer to him, yeah, little Henry Pole. I refer to him as the third missing prince in the tower.
Exactly. Very good. Yes, that's exactly right.
He
Yeah.
vanishes.
He just vanished. He just vanished.
Yeah, really, really odd. Really, really odd
Yeah.
what happened there. So what role did Gertrude actually, because that I think there is more to suggest that Gertrude, we discussed this earlier, that Gertrude was quite a schemer. There is more evidence that Gertrude was actually speaking treasonously than her husband was. So what did she sort of, what was she accused of when the Exeter conspiracy sort of came out?
So she was, I agree, she was definitely a plotter and a schemer. And she certainly exchanged letters with Reginald Pole at some point, but she burned them. She also urged Chapuys to move Charles V to invade England. So that's again, that's treason. So it's interesting that Henry VIII didn't have any hard evidence that treason was committed during, you know, this Exeter conspiracy. Only he had only snippets of conversations confessed by Geoffrey Pole. So after the executions of Montague and Courtenay and Edward Neville, the king arrested Nicholas Carew, his master of the horse, because Carew spoke up against the speed and secrecy surrounding Exeter's trial. And Chapuys actually said that Henry VIII wanted to execute Carew to give more weight to the charges against Exeter. And Carew, you know, when Gertrude was in prison, he asked the king if he can send her a comforting letter. So the king was like, why would you send a comforting letter to a wife of a traitor? Like, why would you do that? And Chapuys also was the one who said that Henry VIII wanted to provide evidence after the trial and after the execution because he didn't really have strong evidence that conspiracy has happened, that there was this plot to assassinate him because there wasn't. So it's very interesting. I think Gertrude was imprisoned because Henry VIII wanted to just grill her to learn as much as possible because he thought. I think he thought that she would crack under the interrogation, like Geoffrey Pole,
Yeah.
because Geoffrey Pole, he cracked and he said a lot of incriminating stuff, and he knew that he failed his family, and he tried to kill himself in the
Yeah,
tower.
twice.
So yeah, and I think that's pretty heartbreaking when you think about it, because he just wanted to save his own skin, and he. You know, to be driven to suicide, it must have really been difficult for him to acknowledge what he had done. And interestingly, Gertrude, she did not provide any evidence that could be used against her husband or against the Pole brothers. So she was, you know, a woman, and she ultimately she proved that she was not frail or afraid. She stood her ground, I think. And I think she was also a lot of times playing dumb, you know, like, oh, I didn't know. Oh, I didn't say that. Or what letters are you talking about? So she was playing that really well. So I admire her for that, that she did not crack under the interrogation.
So she was, you mentioned a second ago that she was imprisoned in the Tower of London, as part of the why, you know, when there was the arrests and executions of the Exeter conspiracy. Gertrude was imprisoned in the Tower of London, as was her son, who I think was about 10 at the time.
10 or
So
12, yeah.
yeah, how long was she actually in prison?
So she was imprisoned in November 1538. I think it was on 5th of November. And she was released on 31st of December 1539. Her son, yes, he was imprisoned, and he would be imprisoned until July of 1553. So he would spend a lot of time in the Tower of London. And while she was imprisoned, Gertrude was writing letters to the constable of the tower and to Thomas Cromwell to help her to intercede on her behalf with the king, which again is quite brave because, you know, her husband was just executed. But I think somehow I think Henry VIII had a soft spot for her because he was very lenient. I mean, he could have her executed, right? He could have, but he released her, and that's pretty surprising.
Yeah, I mean, I refer to Geoffrey Pole's release as the single biggest surprise Henry VIII ever made, because, you know, this was a man who, you know, there were many, many people executed on far, far less charges, on far less proof than Geoffrey Pole, than there was against Geoffrey Pole. But Gertrude's being released without charge and not executed is another of the big surprises, especially when, as we just discussed, there is more to pin against her having committed treason than her husband, and certainly Margaret Pole, who was executed. And I'm curious to know your opinion on this, but my view is that what spared Gertrude was that Margaret was a Plantagenet and Gertrude married one, and that just by definition, Margaret was therefore more dangerous. She had royal blood, Gertrude didn't. Gertrude married into royalty. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Yes, I definitely would. Yes. And it seems to me that Henry VIII was bent on destroying the Plantagenets, perhaps to make sure that none of them would be a threat to his son, because Henry was struggling with his health. He knew that he would probably die when his son Edward was still a minor. And I think he wanted to make sure that none of the Plantagenets would be alive to threaten Edward's rule. I think that's Henry VIII's motivation here. I don't know how he would have reconciled killing innocent people with, you know, being a God-fearing man because he perceived himself as such. But definitely, he somehow convinced himself that these people were a threat to him. So I think it has a lot to do with the fact that he was, you know, perhaps believing that he would die soon, and he wanted his son to rule when there was no Plantagenets at court. But then again, that doesn't explain really why was Edward Courtenay left in the tower? Why was he spared? Because he was, you know, the next generation of the Plantagenets growing up right there. And yeah, it's very interesting that he paid for his medicines when he got sick, and he gave him tutors. So very interesting. Henry VIII was one big contradiction, wasn't he?
A mass of contradictions. And I think actually, again, it kind of highlights Mary's opinions on all of this, because one of the very, very first things she does when Mary becomes queen is to release Edward from the tower.
She did release him, yes. And it's very interesting because among Mary's first actions when she becomes queen, she calls for Gertrude. She calls her to her side, and Gertrude comes immediately, and she becomes her lady in waiting, member of Mary's privy chamber. There is this reference to Gertrude as being Mary's bedfellow. So she slept in Mary's bedchamber. So that's a very privileged position. So it actually speaks volumes about what Mary actually thought about the executions of the Pole brothers and her former governess, Margaret Pole, Henry Courtenay. So yeah, I think in a way Mary feels like she should, you know, make it all better by favoring the Courtenays and the Poles, of course. So I think Henry VIII would have probably turned in his grave if he knew that
yes,
his arch traitor Reginald Pole comes to England and reinstates the Catholicism. I think that would have been a huge shocker for him. And then again, it shows us what Mary kind of thought about her father, because she later in the reign, she compared herself to a defenseless virgin who lived in the time of tyrants. So I think, you know, the reference is pretty clear here. What was she trying to convey? Yeah.
So you sort of very beautifully came on there to Gertrude's later life. So what were her last years like? You know, was she? I think we don't actually know when she specifically died. Is that correct?
Yeah, we don't have like a specific date, but she made her last will. So I think it was between December of 1557 and January of 1558. I think 8 January 1558, her will was proved. So she was definitely dead by then. So somewhere between December 1557 and January 1558 would be her the date when she died. So she lived a long life after her husband's execution. And she kind of disappeared from the record between her release from prison in 1539 and Mary's accession in 1553. There were some vague references to her. She was really trying very hard to have her son released from the Tower. She was first trying with Henry VIII, but when she saw that that was not about to happen, she pleaded with the king to at least allow her son to have tutors so that he would be educated, because education meant a lot, especially if you were an aristocrat, a nobleman. And there is this myth that Edward's wit was dulled by years of imprisonment, but actually it's not the case, because he was he studied behind bars, he was eloquent, he knew French, Italian and Latin. He read a lot. So I think it was the French ambassador Marillac who said that he was so eloquent that it was surprising that he spent so many years in prison. And so Gertrude kind of emerges from obscurity in July of 1553. She becomes lady-in-waiting to Mary. She takes part in Mary's coronation. Her son Edward is released. During Mary's first parliament, Mary gives back Edward's title. He receives the Earldom of Devonshire, some of his father's lands. And Gertrude thinks that Mary should and that she would marry Edward. But Mary doesn't really want that, because she always wanted to marry someone who is her social equal. And Edward was not her social equal. He was beneath her. He also said that, you know, because he was in prison for so long, how can she know what's he's made of? What kind of husband would he be? And also he was, I think he was younger than her. So I think he was 26 when he was released. So her husband, Philip II, was at the same age, I think, also 10 years younger. So, you know, she that was just an excuse that she said, oh, the Edward is too young for me. She didn't really want him. She wanted someone like her social equal. So a king or a prince. And this really kind of soured the relationship between Mary and Gertrude, because Gertrude believed that after all that she went through for Mary, you know, supporting her and her mother, that Mary should marry her son. But she didn't. And Gertrude left court for a little bit, you know, after when Mary married Philip. But then she returned and it was all well again between them. So Edward Edward's whereabouts are really kind of interesting because he was involved in some plots against Mary, and he was sent to Italy by Philip II, and he died there in his early 30s. I think he was quite young, and Gertrude's heart was kind of broken by his death. You know, she didn't have any grandchildren, so you know this the Courtenay line was kind of broken by his death.
Yeah, like the Pole family, they're these two families that are sort of so linked, and they go extinct effectively, don't they? I mean, that's the sad part of their story as well, is that they essentially go completely extinct. She's just a fascinating character, and I mean, I loved reading your book because it was just really it sort of opens up this figure who was really privy to so much of what was going on, and very, she's a bit like in a similar sort of way that like a Jane Boleyn, for example, this sort of tertiary figure who saw so much and was there for so much, but is just overlooked by history. And I think that's what is so fascinating about her story. What do you think is her legacy?
Oh, I think that her legacy was intertwined with the political and religious and familial dynamics of the Tudor court, and it kind of contributes to our understanding of this period in English history. So, for example, it shows that women had influence on politics, and not merely as, like silent observers, but as prominent figures at the forefront of the power struggle. So I think her story serves as a compelling reminder that women did exert power, and they were behind the scenes, but not as this just silent witnesses. It was a time of profound, it was a time of profound religious and societal transformations. So it was really kind of difficult to navigate, I think. But Gertrude succeeded, and I think she should be remembered as this political figure in her own right.
Yeah, a survivor as well, just a total survivor.
Survivor, yes,
Yeah,
definitely.
absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on to discuss Gertrude today. She's, as I say, she's just a fascinating character, and I think I hope, well, firstly, people, if you don't go out and get Sylvia's book, then I'll come for you because it's a fascinating read. And thank you again for coming on to the
Thanks.
podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for having me so much. It was a great fun to talk to you about Gertrude today.
What are you working on at the moment? Where can you say what you're working on at the moment?
I'm working on several things. I always have so many plates spinning at the same time. I'm working on some papers that I hope will be published later this year. My next book is entitled Rival Queens, Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn. So keep an eye for that. So this is what I can tell you at the moment.
Well, as I said, thanks so much again for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And so that brings us to the end of this week's episode of the Tudor Chess Podcast. My thanks again to my guest, Sylvia Barbara Soberton, for coming onto the show and discussing Gertrude Courtenay with us. Tomorrow, the fifth episode in my Patreon exclusive series, Historian Unwrapped, will land. And in this episode, I'm speaking to none other than Dr. Owen Emerson. To access this, plus all other content from the Tudor Chest, just head to patreon.com/thetudorchest. Thank you again, and speak soon.